This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, KenaiSoul.net. This is the Kenai Conversation. I'm your host, Sabine Pooks. Soldotna resident Al Hirschberger was just 18 when he enlisted in World War II as part of a battalion of almost 80 Americans sent overseas in the 1940s. Now, as a 95-year-old, he thinks he's the last surviving member of his battalion. We spoke with Hirschberger the day after Memorial Day about his time in the war, how he reconnected with members of his battalion later in life, and what it was like revisiting Germany as an adult. We also asked him what it was like to hear the war was over in 1945 and his worries about Nazism resurging in the United States today. Here's our conversation with Soldotna's Al Hirschberger.
But can you say a little bit about what Memorial Day means to you?
Well, it's a time when I reflect back on, first of all, my time in the service and also the other people that are no longer with us, that lost their lives in combat as well as afterwards too. So it, in my own case, it's about two, there was, when I went overseas in World War II, I went over in the Field Artillery Battalion, and my battery were 77 of us. We all survived the war. And then after the war, we went every which way, because some of them had been in the service a long time, some shorter term timers like me, and they all went different directions. I kept track. In fact, I came to Alaska with one of them, and kept in touch with a few of them. And as time went by and the internet came along, I began to find more and more of them. So I would say that in the last 20 years, I found perhaps 10 or 15 of them.
On the internet?
On the internet.
How? On Facebook?
No. No, I would Google their names. I have a roster of them, of course. And I would also Google my battalion, the 670th Field Artillery Battalion. And I still Google it every now and then, but I don't get any hits, you know, new stuff, because most of them have, well, they've all passed on, and my battery, and my 2 years ago, about 2 years ago, I became, to the best of my knowledge, the last survivor. And up until that time, I was still finding people up to a year before they passed away, actually, some of them. And anyway, and then of course, now I can't do that anymore. And to me, being the sole survivor is not a fun thing. It's sad. And every now and then I think about something, or I may possibly read something about my battalion, not very often anymore, but, and I'd like to call them and tell them, but I can't because they're gone.
What was it like reconnecting with people from your battalion?
It was great. It was great. It was great. And I probably 10 or 15 of them I've connected with over the years. And a number of them that I did find, a number of them passed away before too long after I found them. And there's still a possibility. There's one or two alive. I can't find anything on them, but I can't find anything that they had passed away or their obituaries or anything about them.
Tell me a little bit about your time in the war. Where were you? And
okay,
tell me about your unit, about what you
okay
were there to
all
do.
All right. I was in the Field Artillery Battalion, and our field artillery, as most field artillery battalions, had five batteries, A, B, and C, were the firing batteries. They had the howitzers, they did the shooting, the firing, the cannons, whatever. Service batteries, what I was in, we did the maintenance and we supplied the ammunition and we delivered the ammunition to the batteries. And headquarters battery was more the medicals. The medical unit was in headquarters battery, the records, the battalion commander, and things along that line. But service battery, we did the work, you might say. We had the maintenance and all of that. But so my particular job was an ammunition handler. And we took the ammunition to the batteries. Most of the, well, to start out with, when we got, we went to, I'll back up a little bit. When I first went in, I was assigned to the Field Artillery Replacement Training Center in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. 17 weeks of training in field artillery. And this was firing the guns, everything involved in field artillery. And then when I graduated from that, they sent me to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, and I joined what they referred to as a line outfit. This was a battalion I was going to go overseas with. And it had happened that earlier, even long before the D-Day invasion, the Army had decided that it would take 100 field artillery battalions to go in after the invasion to clean up afterwards. So my battalion was one of those 100 battalions. And so then, this was in December of 1944 when I was sent down there. And then towards the end of January 1944, we went to Boston from South Carolina. We went to Boston, got on the boat, and went overseas. And it was in the North Atlantic. And it was cold and miserable and rainy and very rough. And for this 18-year-old farm boy, it wasn't exactly fun getting seasick. And but anyway, we managed to get there. It was 2 weeks on the ship, and we're in a convoy of about 40 ships. Landed in France at Le Havre, and they found a chateau for us in Normandy. And we stayed there till we got all of our equipment, which took a while because they were shipping things overseas constantly, and you just had to wait till your turn came to get your equipment. But anyway, when it finally everything got there, all the equipment, then we were ordered to go up and on the front lines. And the front lines at the time was Rhine River. And so my first experience there was we had our battery set up on a hill above the Rhine River, and we always delivered our ammunition. By the way, the ammunition that we handled, it wasn't little bullets. It was 95-pound projectile. And being short and little, and I weighed 120 pounds when I went in the Army, handling 95-pound projectile as many times as I did kind of wore me out. But anyway, we deliver this ammunition in the night after dark, and we didn't use our headlights. We use these little cat eyes on the truck, so the head truck driver had to know where he was going, and the rest followed those little dots behind him. And we get up and unload our ammunition at the batteries. That was my first time I got to see the Rhine River. It was pitch dark, of course, and I couldn't see it, but there were tracers flying back and forth across the river because we were shooting things that way, and Germans were shooting things back at us. And then all of a sudden, the clouds kind of parted, and I looked down there, and I could see this big, wide river down there. I was impressed. I was looking down. It didn't last very long. The clouds came in and obscured it again. But anyway, we delivered ammunition there. Not daily, but almost daily, because we fired into Duisburg for about a week. And then we moved south and fired into Dusseldorf for about a week. And then we eventually crossed the Rhine River, and eventually the war ended.
So there would be people shooting across the Rhine.
Yes.
And you would be there helping them load their ammunition.
Yeah, we took the ammunition over to our batteries who were dug in. They dig in, field artillery, they dig in. It's kind of sunk into the ground a little bit, so you had to dig in. Or didn't always do it, but most of the time they dug in. We'd go over and deliver what ammunition they wanted, and then we'd go back. And the next night, or whenever they wanted more ammunition, we'd go over and bring it to them.
So you were there when the war ended?
I was further south when the war ended. I was down it was in Germany, a town called Heidmühl, a small town. And my battery was living in the railroad station. We occupied the railroad station, and we were delivering ammunition to Czechoslovakia. We had batteries set up in Czechoslovakia and in Austria, and back and forth. And we delivered ammunition there. And then towards the 6th or 7th of May, we stopped. We didn't fire the guns anymore, or very little. We only, I think for a day or two, didn't fire the howitzers at all. And the rumors were the war was over, but nobody really knew. And so we got word on the 8th of May in the morning that we should be at a theater in this small town by 2 p.m. So we went over there, and the Signal Corps had set up radios and our A radio and speakers on the stage. Nobody said anything. We just walked in. It was a lot of people there besides our battery. There were others there, too. And nobody said anything, and they turned it on. And at 2 o'clock, we heard the voice of Winston Churchill telling us that, indeed, the war in Europe is over.
Wow. What did you feel in that moment?
Disbelief. Disbelief. Nobody said a word. Absolutely nobody said a word. There were, I don't know how many there were there, 150, 200 people, I'm not sure. Nobody said a word. Nobody in my battery said a word. We went back to our railroad station, and we had been told that the Nazi propaganda was that Hitler had super weapons down there where we were. And when we got down there, they were going to use those super weapons and wipe us out. So my thoughts were, this is some kind of a trick. The Germans surrendered, but they're just waiting for us to surrender and lay down our arms and get off guard, and then they're going to kill all of us. That was my thoughts. And it took a while before I could get over it.
Wow.
But I think everybody else had the same feeling because nobody said anything.
How did you get involved in the war in the first place? You said you were 18?
Yes. Okay. There were several things that happened to me that I think in a way might have saved my life. But when I turned 18, I registered for the draft. And they were drafting people right and left at the time. And I was working on a farm in Indiana. And farm help was hard to get. And so if you work on a farm, you could get an exemption. I forget what they call it. I call it an exemption. You didn't have to go. So I didn't really want to. I thought I'd like to go. But anyway, my parents and the guy, the farmer that I worked for, they wanted me to do this. So I signed up for a 6-month exemption. And, of course, then I didn't have to go. Well, and the guys that went when I would have gone, a lot of them were that I knew were involved in D-Day, in the invasion. Several of them didn't come back. So anyway, then after my 6 months was up, I went to the draft board and I said, I'm ready to go. And I couldn't enlist because enlistments were frozen. You could enlist if you had a specialty. I don't remember what they were, but I didn't have anything. You know, I was just a farm boy. And I said, I'm ready to go anytime you want me. So they said, okay, we'll call you, we'll send you a letter, and you can come and go down and get your physical. That was normal. You'd go down to Fort Benjamin Harrison, Indiana, Indianapolis, and get your physical. Then if you pass, then we'll call you when we want you. Well, I got called to go down and get my physical. So I went down there, and there was a whole busload of us guys. They forgot, the clerk had forgot to put my papers in there. So anyway, I went, I had to go back and wait till it's all over, wait again another, I don't know how long I waited before they sent me down. In the meantime, guys that did go in when I would have gone in at that time, they were involved in the Battle of the Bulge, and some of them lost their lives that I knew.
So the timing for you worked out?
It worked out. It did. Yeah.
Did you know a lot of people who died then? You said that everyone...
Quite a few of my age, yes. Quite a few. Yeah, I say quite a few. It's been so many years ago. I would guess there were probably at least a dozen that died about that time that I knew, either knew very well or knew who they were. And so, yeah.
That must have been scary.
It was.
So what made you want to be part of this?
You know, most people in World War II wanted this war to be over with. They wanted to end favorably. The Nazis were going to overrule the country. They were going to rule the world if they could, and everybody knew that. And so to defeat Hitler and his group was, and the Japanese to a certain extent, although people on the West Coast were more involved in the Asian War, and in the Central States and the East Coast were more involved in the European War. But I thought, we got to get this over with. Let's go. And everybody that, well, I say everybody, a lot of people that I knew were going and were already there, you know. And so when I could go, I went.
Can you talk about what it was like, what the relationship between you and the other people in your unit was like?
You know, I think about that every day because they're all gone. But in basic training, of course, that was 17 weeks, I had a lot of people around me that were close buddies. When I went to my line outfit, there was only, three or four or five that went with me. The rest of them went to other units, you know. So when I got into this new outfit, I knew altogether maybe four or five people or so. But it didn't take long. And when once we went overseas and went through a few things, I don't know, they were part of family. They were family. Even those that you didn't care too much about, but you were sort of family. And then when we finally, when the war ended and we broke up, that was a hard thing to do, because here we had these 77 guys and we had been together for quite a while. And when the war ended, they had a lot of field artillery battalions, and each one of them had people in it that had been in the service for a long time. Some had only been a short time, so they came up with a point system. You got 1 point for every month you were in service. You got 1 point for every month you were overseas. You got 5 points for every battle you were in. You got 5 points for every a medal, like the Bronze Star, the Purple Heart, or Silver Star, or any of those. You got 5 points for that. And you got some points for dependent children, if you had dependent children. So these points added up. So what they did is they took some of the battalions and assigned them in, they were different categories, four or five, category four or category five, but one of them were all old-timers. And they were scheduled to go back, and they did. And the younger ones, the lower pointer ones were put in other battalions, and we were getting ready to go to the invasion of Japan. And we were set to go in December, was the first invasion of Kyushu. And this information didn't come out till 30 years after the war ended. But I was scheduled to go in Kyushu in December, my battalion. And of course, the atomic bomb took care of that, so I didn't have to go to Japan. And then things changed completely.
And what was it like coming back from war, and was that a difficult adjustment?
No, it wasn't, because I was in Germany 14 months after the war ended. And so we were adjusting to civilian life, even though we were not civilians. But we, in fact, we had turned in our rifles, we turned in our weapons, and towards, and I don't know when, at one point, and we had all kinds of things going on. We weren't civilians, of course, we were military. Actually, what they did, I got lucky. My unit was, because our battalion commander was a very close friend of Eisenhower's chief of staff. And so they had us go to Frankfurt, and we became part of Eisenhower's headquarters command, and we ran the motor pool. And so, it was, we had all kinds of things there. We had a service club, Red Cross club. We had all kinds of things, and we, it was different. And so the adjustment was not, had it been immediately the war, after the war ended, it got out, that would have been an adjustment. But having all this time to get civilianized, and so it wasn't hard at all, no.
And you mentioned you had someone in your unit who also came to Alaska.
Yes.
Why did you come up to Alaska?
Okay, I got out, and we got out at the same time. He was from New Hampshire, and we kept corresponding, and I was working in Indiana in a rubber factory. We made industrial rubber grommets and O-rings for Caterpillar and General Motors and stuff like that. And it was kind of a hard job, and it paid fairly well, but I was kind of bored, you know, and I missed all my buddies, of course. And during the winter, 46 and 47, I got a letter from him, and he says, "I'm going to go to Alaska in the spring. Would you want to go with me?" Without even thinking, I said yes. And we did. We came up together.
Tell me about that friend of yours.
Okay. He came up, and we worked together in Chattanooga, in north of Fairbanks. We went out that winter to Chicago to diesel mechanics school under the GI Bill, and came back in the spring. And he went over to Flat, and I got a job in Kenai. And eventually I was made the shop foreman in Kenai for the Alaska Road Commission. So I hired him, and he came down. And then he homesteaded North Kenai. And he lived here until, 20 years ago or so. He went back to New Hampshire. He bought the farm where he was born and lived there. And anyway, 2 years ago, he died on my birthday.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Which was kind of special in a way, and I still correspond with his wife, and she lives in New Hampshire. That's his second wife, because when he homesteaded here, he was married to another woman, and they divorced eventually, and she died many years ago, and then he remarried when he got back to New Hampshire.
What was his name?
Hedley Parsons.
So when you got to Kenai, were there a lot of other veterans living here?
There were veterans, yeah, but Kenai didn't have a lot of people in 1948. So, yeah, there were. In fact, I got a job at the Alaska Road Commission, and we had, I would guess that, I don't know how many people were working there at the time, not a whole lot, but I would guess that probably half of them were World War II veterans at the time. And but there weren't a lot of people working there, but there were a few, yes. And but like I say, there weren't very many people in Kenai in 1948.
So you were 22 at the time?
Born 1925, well, I guess that's about right, yeah.
So you mentioned you reconnected with a lot of people in your unit online. At that time when you had just gotten out of the war, were you able to be in touch with them through letters, or were you keeping in touch with people then?
I kept in touch with Headley, of course, with letters. And people didn't call very much in those days because you had to wait till after 6 o'clock, and it cost was expensive. It cost a lot of money to call from Alaska to the States in those days. And so most of the people that I got in contact with were quite a few later, you know, like, I got a hold of one in Missouri, and that was about, I still had the furniture store over here. That was in the early 70s. And I don't know how somehow I got his phone number. It was long before internet, but I got a hold of his phone number and called him, and it was him. And then about the same time, I got a hold of another one, and I don't know how I got these numbers because it was before the internet. And he was in Kentucky, and I went down and visited both of them at one time or another. And then, of course, in later years, you Google them, and you come up, you get their phone number, their address, and everything else. And so the last 10 years or so, I contacted several of them. And I visited one in Oregon, one in Utah, one in Kentucky, and one in Missouri that I just come out sort of out of the blue, you know. And anyway, these guys mean a lot to me, you know. Their memories mean a lot to me. And
when you reconnected with them, could you immediately pick up where you left off?
I would say so, yes. Yeah. And of course, it was constantly, do you remember when? You remember this? You remember that? You remember
this? A lot of reminiscing.
Yeah. And every now and then, one of them would disagree with me, or I'd disagree with him. No, it didn't happen that way, but not very often.
I know something a lot of people have been talking about is how, you know, after the war, a lot of people came back and really struggled with mental health, mm-hmm. or maybe, mm-hmm. you know, weren't able to deal with that. And that's kind of another big cause of death for people.
Yes.
Is that something you saw happen among friends, or you saw firsthand?
A little bit of it happened to me, and I didn't, and this was early. Later on, first of all, I wasn't in those real bad situations. You know, I saw dead people and all that, but it wasn't, and it was times it was a little dangerous, but there were many, many, many people that were far worse off than the situation was a lot different. But I did have nightmares occasionally for several years, not often, but just occasionally, and I dream I was in battle, and I don't remember what all was going on. Then I'd wake up scared, but none of it actually bothered me during the day anything. It was the nightmares that I would have occasionally, but that lasted a couple of years at the most, and I never saw anything on any of the others that I could see. But again, I did not experience as bad as a lot of people did. I always felt fortunate I didn't have to. We were, generally speaking, we were behind the lines far enough because we always had a place to go to, and we didn't always have a place to go to, but we got back and go get our ammunition and deliver it, and we didn't have to sit there and be shelled at for day after day after day like a lot of them did. So, but
sounds
I can.
Sounds like you were right there, though.
We were there. Yeah, we were there. We were, but we'd go up and deliver the ammunition, and then we'd come back.
Still.
And
It's hard to imagine being in a situation like that.
Yeah, and So it was always glad to come back. Although we'd go back to wherever we were at the time, a few miles from where our artillery was set up. But there was all night long, shells would be flying overhead. You could fire our equipment in the back. The heavies would fire, and then they were loud booms, and you could hear them whistling overhead, and then they'd land on the other side of the river or wherever and explode. Then the lighter artillery was behind us. They would take off and hear them flying overhead. And so there was constant noise, but you kind of got used to that. And it was when they landed close by that you got scared. And that happened a few times, but not too bad, you know.
Did you feel like the supports for people coming back from war back home were up to the task or were sufficient to meet the needs of folks? Or
I don't think it's ever been sufficient.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know Michael Skinner. I didn't know much about him. He's a good friend. And he took his own life. And I didn't realize he was going through PTSD as he was, because I knew him fairly well. And no, there's never enough. There's never enough support. I didn't really need it, because I wasn't involved that much. And I say I didn't need it. Everybody needs a little. But there are a lot of people, because of what they go through, they need a lot more. And I don't think there's really enough support.
It sounds like for you, an important support was community and reconnecting with the people who went through that with you.
Oh, yeah, it was. It was, yes. It very much so, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Is it hard to not be able to talk to those the folks?
Yes, yes, it is. Yeah, yeah.